Dear Sangha, today is the last day of 2011. Now it's about 4 o'clock for in the afternoon. The new year will come in 8 hours. Let us visualize the new year, 2012, as a giant bird. She is coming to transport us. And she will come in 8 hours. She will come to the Far East first. She will come here in 8 hours, but just in 2 hours she will come to Japan, Korea, and then Vietnam. And the people there will board, will be boarding in 2 hours to get on the wings of the giant bird. And the bird will come here in 8 hours, and we will continue to climb, and then it will fly to America for the people over there to board, and then there we go for the new year. Where she's coming? Does she come from the future to the present, in order to bring us to the future? Or has she come from the past and transport us to the future? And let us visualize that we are sitting on the giant bird and fly together to the future. Suppose you are in an airplane, and the hostesses ask us to fasten the seatbelt to get ready for takeoff. We are going somewhere. Where are we going? On a trip like Paris, New York, they offer us food and motion pictures, cinemas, in order for us to forget that we have to fly many hours. The purpose of offering us food and pictures is just for us to forget, so that we can arrive at the destination as soon as possible. But the practice of pilgrimage goes in the opposite direction, because every moment of the flight should be a delight. We don't want to forget. We don't want to use food and movies in order to forget. You want to be there with every moment. We are flying to the future, and every second of the future becomes the present when we touch. And in every second of the future that becomes the present, we should be able to discover many wonders of life in that moment. So we don't want to forget. We don't want to use food and cinema to forget. We don't want to arrive. We arrive at every moment. We don't need something to help us to forget. That is the difference. And in order to enjoy our flight together, we have to use our seatbelt. This is a kind of special seatbelt, the seatbelt of mindfulness, to help us not to lose ourselves in the future or in the past, to keep us right there in the here and the now, so that we can experience life deeply in that moment. And every one of us here in this hall is provided with the seatbelt. Let us fasten our seatbelt so that we can be truly in the here and the now. And together we will discover the new years in every moment, in every second. And that is the way we go. We don't want to forget. We treasure every moment. We treasure every minute. We don't need to forget times. We don't need time to go quickly. We don't want time to go quickly, because time is life. According to our practice, every second has in itself a lot of jewels. Each minute, each second is a jewel. And you look into the jewel, you see the sky, the earth, the trees, the hills, the river, the ocean. So beautiful. So we don't want to kill time. We want to profit the most from the time that He is giving us to live. And the bell of mindfulness helps us do so. We do not want to waste our life. We want to profit deeply from each moment of life that is given us to live. And that is why we need mindfulness. Mindfulness in order to be able to be there in the here and the now. Mindfulness produces concentration. Concentration helps us to touch deeply what is there in the present moment. And when mindfulness and concentration are there, we begin to see the wonders of life. We begin to get the insight deep into the nature of ourselves and of the world, in order for us not to be carried away by afflictions like anger, fear, despair. And even hope. So it's quite different from boarding a plane in order to go somewhere. We want to forget the time we spend. As a sangha, we need to help remind each other of this practice. Time is very precious. And each morning when we wake up to life, we see that we have a gift, 24 brand new hours. Every morning when you wake up, like bring to your door 24 brand new hours. And up to you to profit from these 24 brand new hours. If you have mindfulness, concentration, insight, if you have compassion, and then you can live deeply these 24 hours. You generate the energy of joy, happiness, and you help other people to live in that way. Personally, Ishapas can do that. But if we live together as a Sangha, it's easier for us to do that because we can remind each other. If any one of us forget, the practice of mindfulness helps us to enjoy deeply every moment of life that is given us to live. The practice of mindfulness helps us to handle our body, our feelings, and our perceptions. If we know how to practice mindful breathing, mindful walking, we can connect with our body. We can touch the wonders of our body. And when we can connect with our body, we can connect with the earth. And when we connect with the earth, we can connect with the whole cosmos. The practice of mindful breathing can help release the tension in our body, can help reduce the pain in our body, can help us touch the wonders of life in our body and around us. The practice of mindfulness can put us in touch with these wonders of life so that we can create moments of joy, moments of happiness. And with the energy of concentration cultivated, we can enjoy deeply every moment of our daily life. The practice of mindfulness can also help us to handle difficult feelings, painful feelings and emotions. With mindfulness, we can handle a pleasant feeling. We can create a pleasant feeling. With mindfulness, we can handle a painful feeling, a strong, difficult emotion. So these things cannot be an obstacle for our getting in touch with the wonders of life. Mindfulness practice apply to listening and speaking can help us restore communication with ourselves, because we can listen to our own suffering. We don't have to try to get away from ourselves. We don't have to cover up what is unpleasant in us. In fact, we try to be there for ourselves, to understand, so that we can transform. We can listen to the other with compassion, to help the other to suffer less. It's called compassionate listening. When you see the other person has suffering in him or in her, compassion might be born in your heart. And you would like to do something in order to help that person to suffer less. You don't want to punish him or her anymore. Instead, you want to help. And that is mindfulness of suffering. You know that your suffering is in you, but in him, in her, there is also suffering. And the other person, because she does not know how to handle her own suffering, she is victim, the first victim of her suffering. And you are only a second victim. And if we are in his or her situation, it will do the same. If we do not know how to handle the suffering inside of us, we will continue to suffer and we will make people around us suffer. So that is the kind of right view that we can get from mindfulness. And when you see the suffering in the other person, you don't blame anymore, you don't accuse anymore, and instead you want to help that person to suffer less. That means compassion has been born in you. But how can you recognize the suffering in the other person if you do not recognize the suffering in yourself? That is why the practice of mindful listening to our own suffering is very crucial. If we accept that suffering is in us, we know how to hold dearly the suffering in us, compassion will arise in us and we will suffer less. And after that, we look at the other person and we know how to help so that the other person will be able to do like us. And one of the things we can do is to listen to him with compassion, listen to her with compassion. That will bring relief in just half an hour or 1 hour. And that is the practice of mindfulness, of listening. And coupled with the practice of mindfulness of compassionate listening, there is the practice of loving speech. You try to tell that person the truth about the suffering in you and in him, in her. The way you speak helps that person to recognize the suffering in himself, in herself, and in you. And help both to find a way to get out, find a way to transform. All these are practices of mindfulness. Mindfulness of listening, mindfulness of speaking. And the five mindfulness trainings that we have received help us to practice mindfulness all day long. If we abide by the five trainings, we are able to handle our suffering. We are able to handle happiness. we can restore communication. We can help the family, the community, and the world to suffer less. And all these things are very concrete practices. They are not theory. 1 hour of practice can already bring some result. And in the Buddhist tradition, we call it applied Buddhism. We have set up the European Institute of Applied Buddhism in Germany. We also have established the Asian Institute of Applied Buddhism in Hong Kong. And this is the kind of practice that we teach to young people, to adult others. And they don't need to be Buddhist. And we hope that we can bring this kind of practice to school. Instead of calling them, calling this applied Buddhism, we call it applied ethics. Because you don't need to be a Buddhist in order to practice this. Everyone can practice mindful breathing and release the tension in his or her body and reduce the pain in his body. Anyone can practice mindful breathing, mindful walking, in order to touch the wonders of life in them and around them, to recognize that they have enough conditions of happiness to be happy right here and right now. Everyone can practice mindfulness in order to be able to take care of a strong emotion like fear, anger, despair. And you don't have to be a Buddhist to call yourself a Buddhist in order to do so. So the art of handling happiness, the art of handling suffering is very important. Everyone can practice compassionate listening and loving speech in order to help restore communication and to reconcile. That is the things we want teachers to teach in school so that they can suffer less in their family, in their relationship, and so on. But this practice of mindfulness is based on a kind of understanding. That we get from the practice of looking deeply. To meditate means to have the time using mindfulness and concentration to look deeply into the nature of what is there. And when we get the insight, we are able to overcome and transform our suffering, our difficulties. So that kind of insight is the foundation for the practice. Ethics should be based on metta ethics. In the Buddhist tradition, we speak of right view. In Buddhism, there is the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. The first truth is ill-being, suffering. Everyone know that suffering is there, ill being is there, and we should do something in order to get out of ill being, to transform ill being. And according to the Buddha, according to our practice, in order to see the path of practice, you have to look deeply into the nature of suffering in order to get the insight. And when you look deeply into the nature of ill-being, of suffering, you can find out, you get the insight about the way of life that can lead to ill-being. And that is the second noble truth. The path leading to suffering, the path leading to ill being. And elements of that path include wrong views. Wrong view. Because you had a wrong view, that is why you have delusion, wrong perceptions, and you do wrong things, and that make you suffer, and other people around you suffer. Wrong view. Wrong views lead to wrong thinking. When you think wrong, there's a lot of anger, fear, discrimination in your thinking. And if you think like that, you destroy your body, your mind, you destroy the world. And wrong view lead to wrong speech. You say things that can destroy, they can be very destructive, and so on. Wrong view, wrong thinking, wrong speech, wrong action, and so on. And that is the second noble truth, the way of living that lead to suffering. And then the third noble truth is the cessation of ill-being, the presence of well-being, that is about happiness. So the four noble truths confirm that suffering is, but happiness also is. Suffering and happiness interact with each other. If you are skillful, it will be suffering. If you are not skillful, it will be suffering. But if you are skillful, it will be happiness. And skillful, first of all, is skillful in a way to look at things. The way you look at things can make you suffer or not suffer. Suppose in a relationship, you think that your suffering has been caused exclusively by the other person. You are only a victim. You suffer because of him or her. That is wrong view. That is wrong view. And wrong view makes you suffer. Right view is that you are responsible to some extent. Right view is that suffering is in you, but it is in him, in her also. Right view is that you do not know how to handle your suffering. You continue to suffer and you make the other suffer. And the other person who does not know how to handle the suffering in him or in her continue to suffer and make you suffer. When you see things like that, you have right view. And right view help you to suffer less right away. You have not done anything yet. Just correcting your view and you suffer less right away. That is why happiness is possible. That's the third noble truth. Well-being is possible. That is the third noble truth. And the fourth noble truth is that there is a way leading to well-being, to happiness. And that is the noble Eightfold Path, beginning with right view. So if you know how to look deeply and get rid of the wrong view, you can already transform the suffering. You have not done anything yet. The way you look at things make you unhappy or happy. And that's why I sit down and look. That is the practice. When you see that the other person is victim of his own suffering, he has a lot of suffering inside, he does not know how to handle suffering in him, he continues to suffer, and he makes you suffer even if he does not want you to suffer. He makes you suffer. But that insight alone makes you suffer already less. You don't want to punish him or her anymore, you want to help. So right view is the heart of all action. And that is why ethics, the practice of applied ethics, should be based on right view. And right view in Buddhism is very deep. According to the Buddha, right view is the kind of view that transcends the notion of being and non-being. And most of us in the world, we are caught by the notion of being and non-being. We believe in birth and in death. We think the birth and death is a objective reality. And we think like this. To be born means from nothing you become something. That's the way of our thinking. And we are sure that is correct. From the realm of non-being, we pass into the realm of being. That is what means by being born. You are no one, suddenly you become someone. From non-being, you pass into being. That is our way of thinking. And Buddha said, that is not right view. And to die, what do we mean to die? To die means from someone, you suddenly become no one at all. To die means from the realm of being, you pass into the realm of no non-being. That's the way we think. But that is qualified by Buddha as wrong thinking. The Buddha said that in the conventional realm of truth, there is birth and death. But looking deeply, there is no birth, there is no death. Suppose we speak about a cloud. Before the cloud appears as a cloud, she has not come from the realm of nothingness. Before being a cloud, she had been something else, like the water in the ocean, the heat generated by the sun. She has not come from nothing, our cloud. So she has not come from the realm of non-being. Her nature is nature of no birth. This is only, being a cloud is only a new manifestation. Before that, the cloud was in another form, water vapor, water in the ocean, and so on. And if we look deeply into the nature of the death of a cloud, we see that it's impossible for a cloud to die, to pass from being into non-being. A cloud can become rain or snow or ice, but not nothing. So if the cloud is not there, it does not mean that it has died. It continues in the other form. So the nature of the cloud is no death, no birth and no death. on the appearance, there is birth and death as conventional truth. But looking deeply, there's no birth and no death. That is the ultimate truth. And science has discovered the same thing. Scientists have agreed with each other that we cannot create matter and energy. Matter can become energy, energy can become matter. The law of conservation of energy, the law of conservation of matter tell us that you cannot create new matter. You cannot create new energy. You can not destroy matter. You cannot destroy energy. The nature of matter and energy is the nature of no birth and no death. The scientists have to agree. They have already agreed on that. Like Lavoisier said, rien ne se crée, rien ne se perd. Nothing is born, nothing dies. So not only in Buddhism we have discovered truth of no birth and no death, but in science we have discovered the same thing. Scientists can create a very small particle called a positron, antimatter. A positive charge, it is opposite of electron, which is negatively charged. And when the positron and the neutron meet each other, collide with each other, there will be a very small sound, and they destroy each other. And out of that are born two very powerful grains of light, photon, called gamma rays. So the positron and the electron do not die. They transform themselves into photon. They continue as energy. Matter becomes energy. And if these two gamma rays collide head on, they will transform themselves into positron, a positron, and an electron again, matter. So there is no destruction, there is no creation. In the realm of Buddhist meditation, we have discovered the nature of no birth, no death, no creation, no destruction. And if you accept the truth of no birth and no death, you have to remove also the notion of being and non-being. Because birth means from non-being you become being. And death is from being you become non-being. And science are trying to knock at the metaphysical door. The science want to find out the ultimate reality. Scientists have been able to apply their findings, their insight in technology. But when they have discovered the nature of no birth and no death, the nature of interbeing, they have not been able to apply it in their daily life. And many scientists still believe that after the disintegration of this body, there is nothing left. you no longer exist. They don't know they're saying like that. They contradict themselves that nothing can die. They see very well that energy is matter, and matter is energy. Matter can be transformed into energy, and energy is transformed into matter, and none of these can be lost. And yet in Buddhism, we see very clearly that our five skandhas, body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness are very active, and they produce energy all the time. We can produce a thought. A thought is energy. We can produce a feeling. Feeling is energy. What we say can be very powerful. What we do can be also very powerful. That is called action. The Sanskrit word is karma. Karma is action. When you produce a thought, if that thought is a thought of compassion and non-discrimination, that thought is a thought of understanding and love, that thought has the power to heal your body, to heal your mind, and to heal the world. And if you produce a thought of hate, of anger, of despair, that you can lead to your destruction, bring you to suicide, and destroy many lives. Suppose a nation together created a collective energy of anger and fear and decide to go to war. Like in the case after September 11th, the whole country produced a lot of fear, collective fear and anger. And that has led to a war that has destroyed millions of people. So karma is very powerful. A thought that we produce can be very powerful, a feeling also. Every thought you produce, everything you say, everything you do, they are force, they are action. They continue always. They are not going to die. It is possible to help transform them, but they cannot become nothing. We have to recognize the power of the spirit, the power of compassion. And we have to be able to apply, to make good use of this in order to change our life and change the world. And that is what scientists can do, can help also. Because these are energies. And Albert Einstein has said something like, the religion of the future should be a kind of cosmic religion, not based on dogmas, on superstition, but based on evidence. Einstein did not believe that there is a God in the form of a person sitting in the sky and decide everything on earth. He doesn't believe in a personal God. But he said that he has a sentiment of religion in him. Every time he observes the cosmos, he sees the great harmony. He sees the elegance, the beauty of the cosmos. And that produces in him a great feeling of admiration and love. And he said that if there is anything religious in me, that is that feeling. And that is in every one of us. Every time we see, we hear something beautiful, harmonious, elegant, we are moved to tears. And that is the basic of the religious feeling. And mankind need a kind of religion to practice together. And that religion should be based on only on evidence. And scientists can help to prove that. In Buddhism, we consider the earth, this planet, as a bodhisattva. We call her Bodhat Thanlung Dia, the bodhisattva of freshness, great earth. We do not qualify, we do not describe earth as a matter. We don't discriminate against between matter and mind. When you observe a human being, we see body and mind. We know the five skandhas lean on each other in order to manifest. We do not see that body and mind are two separate entities. Body and mind are like two sides of a coin. You cannot take them separately. You cannot take the body out of mind, out of the mind. Without the body, there is no mind. You cannot take the mind out of the body. They lean on each other in order to be, they manifest together. Like the right and the left. The right and left, although they look like two opposite things, like they look like enemies, opposite. But they are always together. If the right is there, the left is not there either. And vice versa. It's like this sheet of paper. You have the recto and the verso. You cannot take the recto out separately because it leans on the verso in order to be. So that is the way we look at the body and mind and everything. You cannot take mind out of body, you cannot take body out of mind because they inter-are. In modern physics, they use the word superposition or entanglement. But the word interbeing is much more beautiful. The left and the right cannot be by themselves alone. They have to interbe with each other. So when you think that you can take mind out of body and body out of mind, that's not right view. And then there is the other couple, consciousness and nature. Classical science is based on the belief that there is a world of reality outside of mind. Whether mind exists or not, the objective reality is there. But in the Buddhist tradition, we always say that the objective reality existing out of the mind doesn't exist. And from the beginning, the world of phenomena are described in Buddhism as objects of mind, minds and object of minds. Mind and object of mind, they manifest at the same time. You cannot take mind out of object of mind, and you cannot take object of mind out of mind. Mind and object of mind, they inter-are. Quantum physics begin to see that. But they have a long way to go. If we get right view, and then our way of thinking will be right thinking. Right thinking is the kind of thinking that is free from discrimination. Discrimination about again between body and mind, light and rest, subject and object. In Buddhism, we have the teaching of dual grasping. You are caught in the idea that mind is one thing and object of mind is another thing that can exist separately. You think of a wave as a wave, and a wave cannot be a particle. Wave cannot be particle, and particle cannot be at the same time wave. So there is a contradiction, the duality wave-particle. And scientists have to accept the contradiction. They have begun to touch the nature of interbeing. They are describing objects of research as having the nature of entanglement, a superposition. So the contact between Buddhism and science can bring wonderful things. And when we look at Mother Earth in a Buddhist way, we don't see that the earth is matter. We don't discriminate against matter and mind. And that is the better way to touch the earth. The earth transcends matter and mind. And when you look deeply, you see Mother Earth is a real bodhisattva because she has many virtues of a great bodhisattva. A bodhisattva can be a person, but can be a planet or a star. And when we look at the earth, we see that she has the virtue of perseverance. She has a lot of stability. She has the capacity to embrace. She has the virtue of non-discrimination. She's very patient. patient. She has a lot of talent. She can create. She's a wonderful artist. She's a wonderful a painter. She offers life. She's very creative. She is the mother of all the Buddhas in the form of humans. Shakyamuni Buddha is a son, is a child of Mother Earth. She is the mother of many Buddhas, saints, and Bodhisattvas. Not only she is the mother of the Buddha, she is the mother of the mother of the Buddha, Mahamaya. She is the mother of the Virgin Mary. She is the mother of Jesus Christ. So if you see the earth like that, you have a feeling of admiration, a feeling of love, a feeling of respect. You don't deal with the earth as matter. And when you approach the earth like that, with the feeling of admiration and love, you have a better connection with the earth. And soon you will realize that the earth is not the environment that you have to protect. The earth is yourself. You are a child of the earth. And the earth is in you. If you know how to protect you protect the earth. If you know how to protect the earth, you protect you. And you no longer discriminate. And in that kind of communion, you are free from the state of alienation that you have been. We have lived in such a way that we get alienated from the earth, alienated from our own body. We spend many hours every day forgetting that we have a body. You are caught in your computer, your problems. You forget that you have a body. The practice is to breathe in, stop the thinking, and go home to your body, and relax your body. And if you can touch your body as a wonder, you have the opportunity to touch Mother Earth in you as a wonder. And the healing begins. Many of us have become sick because we have suffered alienation from our body, from the body of the earth. So the practice is to go home to our Mother Earth and to heal, to get the healing. Mother is ready to receive us at any time to help us being nourished, being healed again. Since many of us are educators, scientists, and spiritual practitioners, there is something exciting for us to do this year, the coming year, sitting together on this planet Earth. We are going on a wonderful trip. Do you know that the Earth is transporting us? The Earth is that giant bird transporting us. And she goes with the speed of 1,600 kilometers in 1 hour, orbiting the sun. We are on it. We should put our seatbelt. We should enjoy. We should fasten our seatbelt. We should enjoy every moment, and what we can do together. It is to set up the ground for a kind of religion that can be agreed by scientists and other philosophers and spiritual practitioners. Suppose we begin with the first statement of Einstein. Every one of us has the feeling of admiration and love when we see the beauty of the cosmos, the beauty of the earth. That can be approved, that can be recognized by Buddhists, Christians, others, and also scientists, right? And I have proposed about 30 things like that we can examine together. And some of this work can be done during the winter retreat, and we continue with the 21-day retreat. We come with the foundation of insight, provided by our practice, our experiment, the findings of many generations of practitioners, and we offer to others, including theologians, scientists, philosophers, yogis, and others. And we propose only the things that can be verified by evidence. And that can be very deep insight also. Like the non-duality between body and mind. The non-duality between subject and object of perception. The energy of mindfulness, concentration, and insight as powerful energies that can help transform. And these things, scientists, they have not tried on themselves. And we know that a session of walking meditation, we know how to use mindfulness in order to breathe and to walk. That bring a lot of healing and transformation. And that is experience. That's not talking. And other people like philosophers, scientists, educators can try by themselves to see. If you can prove the opposite, we will abandon. But if you cannot prove the opposite, we still keep like that, we continue to practice. One of the things we propose here is that there are two kinds of truth, the conventional truth and the absolute truth. In the conventional truth, there is birth, death, going, coming, being and non-being. But in the absolute truth, in the ultimate dimension, there is no birth, no death. No beginning, no end, no being, no non-being. That is one of the discoveries of spiritual practitioners. Remember when the Buddha was asked, what is right view? He began by, right view is the view that transcends the notion of being and non-being. And as scientists have agreed that there is no birth, no death. Nothing is created, nothing can die. Why do they have to continue looking for the beginning of the cosmos? Why do they have to create theories like the Big Bang? And having created the theory of the Big Bang, they have to think of the Big Crunch, the Big Crush. They have not made use of what they have found, the nature of no birth and no death of everything. and matter, energy, that are everything. So it is possible for spiritual practitioners and scientists to sit down, to work together. We agree that we will not believe in anything that is not based on evidence. And if we can offer the world such a path, and you can choose a name for that path, we will be able to reduce discrimination, division, hate, and help build peace. Because what we believe has the solid ground of evidence. Suppose we say, the earth is the most beautiful thing we have seen in the cosmos so far. In calligraphy, I have written that sentence, Mother Earth is the most beautiful Bodhisattva. And I take refuge in Mother Earth. Mother Earth is not an abstract idea. You don't have to believe in Mother Earth as something abstract. Mother Earth is there as an evidence. She has given us life, and we can go back to her, and she will bring us to life again and again and again. And if we touch our body, our mind deeply, we discover the nature of no birth and no death, and we transcend fear. So I take refuge in the Bodhisattva Earth. Is something that everyone can do. Maybe people are not familiar with the word Bodhisattva. But a Bodhisattva or a saint has so many virtues, then our planet has these beautiful virtues. And we have used so many giant telescopes, and we have looked around, we have seen distant galaxies, and we have not found anything like as beautiful as this planet Earth. Where else do you want to go? When Mother Earth is ready to welcome you home in order to help you to manifest again and again, because you are not going to die. It's impossible to die like that cloud. If a cloud cannot die, how can you die? And what science has discovered is enough for a dialogue. Science has discovered that time is not an absolute, universal, objective thing. Time and space. Time is not something that can exist by itself alone. Time has to interbe with space. You cannot take space out of time, and you cannot take time out of space. Scientists are ready to accept that. And matter also. Matter modifies time. Energy also modifies time and space. So time and matter, space and matter, they interact. You cannot remove matter from time and space. You cannot remove space and time from matter. So everything inter-are. Things do not exist as separate entities, science began to see that. So in the year 2012, we have something very exciting to do. To lay the foundation for a kind of cosmic religion that everyone, including scientists, can accept. We shall practice together. Concerning the two kinds of truth, I think in the realm of science, they do have it also. In classical science, represented by Newton, we say we can explain many things. And it's a very applicable. But the truth of classical science cannot answer all the questions. That is why we have to go further. And from the historical dimension, we slowly go to the ultimate dimension. From the world of birth and death, being and non-being, we go to the realm of no birth, no death, no being, no non-being. And the two dimensions are not cut off from each other. When we get in touch with the historical dimension and deeply enough, you touch the ultimate dimension. It's like when you try to get in touch with a wave. A wave represents the world of phenomena. A wave has birth and death, going up and going down. To be or not to be. And a wave may suffer a lot because of these notions. A lot of worries, a lot of anxiety, fear, jealousy, and so on. But if the wave go back to herself and discover that she is water, things will change. If she recognizes she is water, everything will change. She is no longer afraid. She sees that she has no beginning, no end. And she enjoys going up, going down. She touched the realm of the ultimate. And she doesn't have to go and look for the ultimate. Because she is the ultimate. She is water. She doesn't have to go and look for water. She is a wave, of course. She can live the life of a wave. But she can at the same time live the life of water. And when she sees herself as water, the fear of non-being, the fear of discrimination, and so will vanish. And she sees that she is in the other waves, and all the other waves are in her. So touching the ultimate will bring a lot of freedom, a lot of non-fear, a lot of happiness. That doesn't mean that the truth in the conventional realm is not useful. Suppose we say that the line that the way going to A and B, the shortest, is the straight line. That is the truth. We can make use of that. But as far as the planet is concerned, sometimes the straight line is longer. And air pilot, they know sometimes to take a curved line in order to arrive more quickly. Suppose two person are walking around the planet, one in front of the other. In the beginning, you see that this person is in the front, and the other person is behind the other person. But if you look at the planet, you see that any one of them can be in the front, because they are going like this. Any of the two can be. And the notion of above and below. We need the notion of above and below in order to know that we will stay in the 10th floor or the ground floor. The ground floor must be below, and the 10th floor must be above. And sitting here in Plum Village, now we are sure that this is the direction of the above, and this is the direction of the below. The people in Japan who are sitting on the other side of the planet, they don't agree. They think this is their below. So in the ultimate truth, there is no below, there is no above. So two kinds of truths do not contradict each other. And if you get deeply with one kind of truth, and if you are not caught, and then you have a chance to touch the other kind of truth. In the Buddhist tradition, the realm of the ultimate is called Nirvana. Nirvana is the ground for everything that has the nature of birth and death, being and non-being. The Buddha said that, well, there is such a thing as the ultimate, where there is no birth, no death, no being, no non-being, no coming, no going, no this, no that. If that is not there, there will be no possibility, no refuge for all the things that have beginning, ending, being, non-being, and so. And the ultimate is not something separated from the historical. It's like the wave is not separated from water. Wave is water. Water is wave. So we do not have the wave does not have to go and seek for water. We do not have to go and seek for the ultimate. The ultimate is us. Only if we change our way of looking, only if we have a right view. So scientists are trying to get the right view of the world. But Buddhist practitioners, they do the same. They are trying to get the right view, but with the intention to suffer less. The right view should be able to liberate us from suffering. We have a purpose. Right view is for our liberation, for our freedom. The moment when you get right view, you are liberated, you don't suffer anymore. And right view is the view that transcends notions of birth and death, matter and mind, body and mind, object and subject, and so on. So the dialogue between yogis and scientists can be very futile, can be very wonderful. And we should not dwell only in the realm of the intellect, because right view in Buddhism is not notions and concepts. Right view in Buddhism is a kind of intuition that gets you in touch with the ultimate, where you have to release all notions, all concepts. And in the realm of science, people know that they have to release concepts in order to get into the kind of view that quantum physics may reveal to them. But in the Buddhist tradition, we learn that your view might be wrong view. What you have learned may not be the absolute truth, might be just a notion. You have to be ready to release it in order for you to go higher. It's like you are climbing a ladder. If climbing to the fourth step, you think that you are highest, that is the end of your climbing. You are to be ready to abandon the fourth in order to climb to the fifth. And in Buddhism, that is called the release of knowledge. Knowledge as an obstacle for understanding. We are ready to let go of what we know, especially in terms of concepts and notions. Suppose you have learned about impermanence, no self, interbeing, and if you got caught in the notion of concept, in these concepts, you have not got the truth. What you need is the insight of interbeing, the insight of impermanence, the insight of no self, but not the notion of impermanence, the notion of non-self. These notions are not able to liberate you, only the insight. Suppose a scientist, after having discovered the nature of no birth and no death, she or he continued to practice. In her life, in her daily life, she looked at everything, and she practiced mindfulness and concentration. Whether she looked at a flower, she can see the nature of no birth and no death in the flower. When she drinks some tea, she can touch the nature of no birth and no death in the tea. And that is called samadhi in Buddhism. Samadhi means to maintain that alive, to maintain that insight as an insight and not as a notion. Because a notion is just a notion. It cannot liberate you. Only the insight that can liberate you. Proposals like to be is to interbe. Things do not exist by themselves. I think there will be no difficulties for people in the realm of quantum physics to accept. because they have begun to see that. Science has discovered somehow that there is no self. And that is not something too difficult to understand. Because impermanence, every one of us is capable of understanding impermanence. Everything is changing. No one can take a bath twice in the same river. When you go to the shore and you go down again, it's not the same river. So everyone is capable of seeing that the river is changing. The river of this moment is not the river of the next moment. And everything is a river. Also the one who takes a swim in the river. She is also a river. And that is why we have to remember, not only we cannot take a swim twice in the same river, but the river cannot receive one person twice. Because when the person go up and go down, she is another person. She's different already. There is a continuum. And in the realm of subatomic particle, the impermanence can be understood as a highest level. And as things are impermanent, how can you believe in something that remains the same forever? Itself. Impermanence means non-self. Impermanence is the same thing with no self. From the angle of time, you call it impermanence. From the angle of space, you call it no self. Suppose you are in the realm of neuroscience. And you look into the brain, you see the brain as a community of neurons. And they communicate each other always. And together they produce a feeling, they produce a thought, they produce a perception. But there is no neuron playing the role of the boss. Conducting. There is a symphony. And that is no self. When we look into our person, we see the body as a community of cells. We see the river of feelings, many kind of feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. When we touch the river of perceptions, we see wrong perceptions, right perceptions, and so on. When we touch the river of mental formations, we see fear, anger, hate, love. Everything is flowing, changing. Everything is of the nature of cinematography, quickly changing. We don't see anything that remains the same that we call a soul or a self. There is only five rivers. Body, feelings, perceptions, mental formation, and consciousness. Outside of these five rivers, there is nothing else. There is no soul, no self, no permanent entity. And that does not mean that when the five skandhas stop operating, well, that is the end of everything. No. Because nothing can die. The five skandhas are producing energy. And when you do not see the five skandhas in their usual form, they continue always in the form of energies. And they will manifest again and again under other forms. So this kind of insight of no self, of no birth and no death, of interbeing, of the ultimate dimension, they are very basic for us to change our life. And based on that kind of insight, we can create the kind of behavior that we call applied ethics. And if we are educators, and if we want to help the young generation to suffer less, we have to master the practice. We have to get the real insight, not just a set of concepts. We have to get insight of interbeing, of non-discrimination. Because that insight is the ground of ethics. They are meta-ethics. And together, we can work like as a sangha. I think educators have to come together and do the work and lay down the foundation of meta-ethics so that what we practice in order to remove suffering, transform the suffering, is based on that kind of insight where there is no longer discrimination, separation. And many of us have received the five mindfulness trainings. We try to put into practice the five trainings in order to enhance, to improve the quality of our daily life. But we know that the five trainings are based on the kind of insight called interbeing. And if you have truly get the insight of interbeing, the feeling of discrimination, the tendency to discriminate, to divide, to be alienated, is no longer there. And the practice will become something natural. We don't have to force it on ourselves. So in the beginning of the five training, there is that sentence, the five trainings are based on the insight of interbeing, where there is no more any discrimination. First of all, the discrimination between being and non-being, birth and death, object and subject of cognition, and so on. So the new year is approaching. And after this, we will do walking meditation, right? Yes. So let us remember that Mother Earth is playing the role of the great bird transporting us. And everyone should fasten our seatbelt of mindfulness and enjoy fully the 365 days that are promised to us for 2012.